You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 74 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tris Parasino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And for the second consecutive week, we are going back to the same beer, but not quite the same beer.
Oh, so close.
So last week, you'll recall, we did the Fremont Field to Ferment Fresh Hop Pale Ale. That was the Centennial Hop that we did last week. This week, we have the Amarillo Hop.
Oh.
And I will tell you all about the difference that we can taste in this beer, because we will 100% be able to do that.
Yeah, we'll definitely be able to taste the difference.
There'll be notes of whatever it is Amarillo hops have. Certainly notes of them. Anything else to say on this topic?
Well, I'm excited to try this other hop.
Yeah, because have you been all Centennial so far?
All Centennial.
No Simcoe, no Citra?
No Simcoe, no Citra.
I assume some of it is like seasonal, right? That like different varieties roll out later.
I think they all pretty much come out at the same time.
Oh, okay. All right.
But a cheers to Amarillo hops.
Yeah. One of my four favorite hops, because I think there's only four that they do for the fresh hop. Maybe I'm missing one.
There's only four total hops.
That's a level of insight you get here on the Peltoncast. That's delicious.
It's very delicious. Tastes exactly the same as the Centennial hops.
Cannot tell any difference. A reminder before we get started. We announced this last week on the pod. Seattle Sports Trivia Night coming Tuesday, October 10th. 2 weeks from now as we record this. Inside 2 weeks when you listen to this. At the Runaway Bar in the Numo's Complex. Where you will, as we discussed last week, have a chance to compete against me head-to-head. And potentially become the third Pelton brother.
Wow. An honor bestowed upon very few.
And maybe, depending on how quickly we get our acts together, maybe another special prize for Peltoncast listeners. So we would love
A surprise that I don't even know about.
You do know about it. You just don't know what I'm talking about.
Can you tweet the link to the Facebook event?
I can tweet
I'm
that.
I'm pretty sure that you and me and the person who we're working with at Numo's are the only people who have RSVP to this.
Is that true?
Yeah, I'm worried it's going to get canceled.
The third person is the person we're working with?
Yeah. Wait, there's still only three people?
I think so. There's lots of people who are interested, including many loyal listeners. They just have not committed.
Not
to
willing
definitely.
To commit. Not willing. No,
I
to
mean,
commit.
That's still a ways.
I'm changing
out.
Myself to interested.
Yeah, you don't want to go too far out on this ledge right now.
But it would be good if you tweeted the link and got people to maybe say that they were going.
That would be phenomenal if people were able to commit that they are in fact going. Yes, we are still at three going. Nine interested.
Oh my god.
That's okay. A lot of interested parties.
It's a good thing we started at the Runaway and not in Numo's.
It definitely is.
doesn't have the same kind of steam as our first ever live Peltoncast, which was great.
It was great. And thank you to the listener for making that great.
So RSVP to that.
That was pretty much it.
But I wanted to get into something that we haven't really talked about.
What's that?
And that is your trip to Denver. Slash Boulder.
Denver slash Boulder and LA. It was a multi-destination trip.
We haven't really talked. This is always the best when I actually find out stuff on the Peltoncast. So we haven't really talked about this trip at all. And it seems like kind of a lot happened. So walk us through what happened to you, I think, starting in Denver.
Yeah, so flew into Denver on Friday night, got in around 9 o'clock and with my friend Todd, and we rented a car and drove out to Boulder. Got there around 10 o'clock, and I was able to quickly tick off. So we were going there for the UW game at Colorado on Saturday. But in conjunction with that, I had only one goal about this part of the trip, and that was there are two burrito places in the Denver area that were in the 538 burrito bracket.
Really?
And a chance to knock those both off. My lifetime goal of getting to all 64 locations in the 538 burrito bracket.
And so did you do it?
Close.
I haven't heard anything about this. I'm genuinely excited to hear about these burritos.
So Friday night, immediately after we went to, got in, we went to Illegal Pete's, which was one of those two locations, and started out in Boulder.
Really? And, that's one of the locations?
Yeah.
So there was a concert that Illegal Pete's, but I thought it was a pizza place.
It is not a pizza place.
Illegal Pete's put on a concert at Red Rocks that a couple of bands that I work with played.
And oh, really? Because they said they have a music label. That was one of the signs in the,
oh, really?
In the place. Yeah, so it's kind of... So the interesting thing about Illegal Pete's, I still haven't looked up. It's highly similar to Chipotle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which also started in the Denver area. I'm not sure what the timing is on those two. Illegal Pete's started in 1995. And
similar to Chipotle.
Yeah,
huh?
So you've got very similar like options for what you're going to put on your burrito and go through the line just like Chipotle. Now, a few key differences.
Okay.
They've got a lot more options of what, I don't know if it's condiments or whatever you want to, not necessarily condiments, but various things you can put in your burrito, including potatoes.
Oh.
They had olives, which I had never seen as an option for a burrito, sadly.
That
I did
doesn't,
not
doesn't with, sound very good.
Yeah, it just didn't seem right. That's like the burritos you make like when you're a small child and you're just like, I like olives, let me put these in here. But then also had the option, which I did avail myself of getting the burrito smothered in a pork chiles, green chili sauce.
Oh, that sounds good.
Which is, that's the thing in Denver. I don't know if you were
aware
of this.
I mean, this looks like a Chipotle looking at the pictures.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Is this
to Chipotle.
Like the Cali Burger version of Chipotle?
No, because I don't think it's like a direct ripoff. I think
two people just happened to come to the exact same idea for a burrito place.
It could be that they copied elements of what each other were doing to kind of end up so similar. Would be my guess, but there's definitely it's distinct. It's distinct as a brand. So I would say that the burrito itself was remarkably unflavorful. It was incredibly bland.
Unflavorful.
So
wow.
I was really counting on the green chili to give it any sort of flavor. I mean, it wasn't bad.
Where do you stand on Chipotle, by the way?
I'm okay with Chipotle. I don't like it the way that you like it or Nate Duncan, who has called it his favorite burrito, even though he lives in
number
the Bay
one
Area.
Burrito. I love that.
Go to the best rated burrito places
God,
in the world.
Nate Duncan have got to hang out more.
You really do. And you didn't hang out when he was in Seattle. A huge missed opportunity for you.
Man.
So, when I say remarkably unflavorful, that's a little too harsh.
I liked it. I like when you just leave it there.
It was a perfectly competent, solid burrito, much like I feel like about Chipotle. Oh, Chipotle's better than
that. Oh, my God.
Than that. But
this is heresy.
The green chili did lift it up a little bit, I would say. So it finished, I've got it ranked 8th now of the 13 burrito locations I've been
okay.
to. So that was our Friday night. Went to another
Those
bar.
Other burrito places that are below it must have been unspeakably bad.
Not necessarily. They just weren't
Do
as
you have
well
Rancho
rounded.
Bravo ranked, by the way?
Yeah, I have them ranked 12th.
Okay, it's pretty bad.
I need to go back.
No,
it's fine. I've only been there once, so I need like a better sample. Maybe I've been there a second time.
But yeah, we should go to Rancho Bravo.
They've opened up new locations. They're really diversifying.
Have they really?
Yeah, there's one in Ballard, I think.
Oh.
Or Fremont. One of those two. Fremont.
Oh, it's really diversifying.
It's just in a different location than Capitol Hill. That's what I meant. I didn't mean in terms of the diversity of the patrons.
Or the types of locations. This isn't Dick's moving into Midway.
It is definitely not Dick's moving into Midway. So Saturday morning at brunch with the friends that I went to the game with, some former coworkers at the Sonics and Storm, drove up from Kansas City where they now live, where I visited them earlier in the year, as we discussed on the podcast, to come to the game. And we're at brunch, getting ready to order, and lo and behold, Carmelo Anthony gets traded. I get a text about it.
Who did you get the text from?
My editor.
Your editor, and just like, hey, heads up.
Yeah.
Carmelo got traded.
Yeah. So Man. I didn't have my computer with me at this point. Our hotel was a couple miles outside of town. Fortunately, the rest of my friends were staying in Boulder, like in the same parking lot as the restaurant we were eating brunch
oh,
at.
Oh, man.
So was able to have someone go back to the room, get the computer, get a laptop, and banged out the Carmelo Anthony trade grades right there at the table.
Nice. Were you? And what did you grade this trade?
I graded an A for the Thunder and a C minus for the A minus for the Thunder and a C minus for the Knicks.
What is your take on the really quick for people who don't have Insider? Who should go subscribe to Insider?
Yes, thank you. People, good save on that one.
Like myself.
Yes, like you. I'm feeling a little bit better about this trade for the Knicks as I think about it. I do think the one thing is, like, you know, if the Thunder were just straight trying to dump Enes Kanter's contract,
yeah,
it probably would have cost them a second round pick to do it. I don't know if a team would just take him into space at this point because of the fact that there's so limited cap space now in the NBA. I mean, there's almost no one that could execute that trade. So, you know, from that standpoint, that's a bit of a negative having to take on his contract for the Knicks, who have a ton of centers now. So that mitigates the fact that they got a really good second round pick out of this trade.
Whose second round pick is it?
It's Chicago's.
Oh, really?
So a pretty good chance it ends up even being the top overall second round pick. Yes. As bad as the Bulls
roster was. I love the
was.
Photos from Chicago's. What do they call it? Press day or whatever?
Media day.
Media day.
I felt bad for the Bulls.
Was it Quincy Pondexter? Because there was a series of photos that was going around.
Yeah, that was the one that was captioned, "Why am I here?"
I really liked that one.
Yeah, Quincy Pondexter, by the way, great story from Chris Haynes on ESPN.com, revealed that he dealt with MRSA during his rehab from multiple knee surgeries and feared for his life, was in a hospital fighting MRSA. So that was a really interesting story.
But they couldn't even get a first-round pick out of it.
I mean, it's not stunning because of the trade, no trade clause, and the size of Carmelo's contract. I mean, that's not stunning. It's just, you know, they didn't get immediate cap relief unless Kanter opts out of his contract next summer, which he probably won't.
But why did the Knicks even bother doing the trade?
Because they wanted to get rid of Carmelo. And they
were just willing to do whatever to get rid of Carmelo.
I mean, from their standpoint, they're probably comparing to this to what if we just bought out Carmelo? And it's probably a better return than that.
How does Oklahoma look in the Western Conference now after this trade?
So I still put this.
I didn't realize we were getting into this, but these are actual questions I have for you that we haven't talked about.
And also questions that I've answered in an article on ESPN Insider. I have them fourth in the Western Conference still.
After
Houston and San Antonio and Golden State. I think this gives them a lineup that potentially is better against the Warriors. So I think it makes them a little bit more of a threat, but I still think the Rockets are the biggest threat to Golden State in the Western Conference.
So I don't have to worry too much about my Not the Thunder fandom.
I mean, certainly you have to worry a lot more than last season.
But it's a one-year deal. Sorry, this is my last question. Carmelo is on the last year of his deal.
He has a player option. It's technically, I think, an ETO on the final season of his contract next year.
So they're still in full-on. I mean, we talked about this when Paul George went to the Thunder. They're in full-on. It is this year bust mode.
I mean, I think Paul George creates that scenario.
But also, all three of their star players are on their last year of their contracts.
For now. Russell Westbrook does have the ability to sign that extension up through opening night, or the day before opening night, I should say.
Is there a chance that that's going to happen?
I think there's a chance it's going to happen.
Do you know about this?
I think there's a chance it's going to happen.
God, are you kidding me? He's going to sign with the Thunder?
I think there's a chance it's going to happen.
Oh. Well, I was so ready to be a Lakers fan. Anyway, so Carmelo Anthony gets traded at brunch. You write about it.
Yeah. And then afterwards, hang out, tailgate before the game. Obviously, a very late kickoff locally, 8 p.m.
It was like 80 degrees in Denver on Friday.
It was actually, I guess it was like Thursday. It was like that. I think by Friday it already turned. Yeah, it was in the 50s in both Saturday and Sunday. And at times on Saturday, just like the kind of pouring rainstorms that you get in pretty much all the country but the Northwest. By game time, it had settled into like, just drizzly, very light rain. It wasn't actually as uncomfortable as we were fearing it was going to be. And no thunderstorms. They did not turn up, at least.
It seemed pretty rough.
It wasn't ideal.
Did you make it to we'll talk about that game later. Did you tailgate at the university?
No, I was on like tailgating in a parking lot. We were just at bars in the Boulder area.
Okay. Were you with other Husky fans?
I mean, the group I was with was other Husky fans. I mean, there was a lot of Husky fans there. I wasn't, like, specifically with other people outside the group, though.
There was, I think, in the first touchdown they scored, it sounded like a home game.
Really?
It was loud.
That's interesting, because I wouldn't say I got that feeling even, you know, sitting in the Husky section. Maybe I just couldn't tell how loud we were elsewhere in the stadium.
Huh. Okay, so you made it to another burrito location.
All right, so Sunday, we drive from Boulder back into Denver in time to watch the NFL games. And shout out to friend of the pod, Jonah Carey. I hit him up on Twitter.
Is Jonah Carey a friend of the pod?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. He doesn't He doesn't know he's a friend of the pod, but he is.
He'll never hear this. He's busy interviewing presidents and dignitaries.
That is definitely true. Prime ministers. And so I asked him for a recommendation for to watch the Seahawks game, and he hooked us up with the location of the place where, like, the local chapter of the Seahawks fan club, booster club, watches the game.
Really?
And it was this awesome, like, giant sports bar near Coors Field, and then all of their sports facilities are generally in the same area. So they've got, like, sports bars really concentrated in that area.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Huh, what a concept. Weird. they make it work somehow. I guess not near the port.
The port of Denver.
So watched the first games, like the first half of the first games upstairs with, you know, view of multiple TVs. Obviously, the Broncos were very prominent at that point. At halftime.
Oh, man. It must have been a sour mood in Denver that day.
It was. At halftime, we left and went about a five-minute drive to the original Chubby's,
okay,
which is a place unlike almost any other in the burrito bracket, in that it was a hamburger stand that a Mexican-American woman became a cook at. I think she purchased it and added her green chili and other Mexican-American staples to the menu. So so their specialty and what was rated in the burrito bracket, and therefore what we tried, is what's known as the Mexican hamburger, where it's a burger patty inside a tortilla with beans.
What?
On paper, this sounds terrible. And it was interesting. The Yelp reviews of this place are not very good, but it's like a Denver institution, so much so that there are knockoffs of this place.
That's why it has to be the original Chubby's.
Well, the other ones call themselves original Chubby's, but they don't have the apparently.
Oh, okay.
That's how you distinguish it. And so ordered this smothered with the green chili on top. It was the single spiciest thing I've ever eaten in my life.
Oh, my God. I want to eat this. I want to have a spice off right now. I mean, first off, I'm really hungry. So this illegal pizza, which you called flavorless, sounded really good to me. But having the single spiciest thing to you, I naturally think to myself, it would be of no spice to me whatsoever.
And it was just like immensely filling. So even though my friend and I, we split one of these.
Wow.
Could not finish the half of it.
After really?
We had eaten like hummus was for some reason the what we went with while watching the first half of the game.
Okay. And not at the original Chubby's. No.
And it that combination like proved super filling. I mean, I didn't eat the rest of the day, but it was terrific.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not realize that's where we were going.
I mean, the even though it was so spicy, it was incredibly flavorful.
Do they have beer?
I think they might have some. I can't remember.
Okay, because the thing about like Sisters and Brothers, right?
Yeah, when you're going to a place that's really spicy, you need
some Nashville Hot Chicken. It is so much spicier than you can possibly imagine.
You're this like way spicier than that.
Really?
I mean, I've had the mild at
well, you go Sisters there and you're Brothers. Like, I've had fried chicken. I can handle it.
Yeah,
and
no, then, this is not that. I mean.
But then you end up drinking like four Rainier Tall Boys because you're like, I just need to get the spice out of here.
Yeah. I was just like going back and refilling my water cup repeatedly.
Did you start sweating?
No, I don't think I sweated at
okay.
all.
Was it a 24-hour experience?
No, it wasn't that bad. Yeah, if I had finished a whole burrito, perhaps. The hamburger wasn't as bad as I kind of feared it would be in the tortilla.
Doesn't sound good.
But I will say, like, I kind of didn't enjoy those bites as much as the ones that were primarily that were the beans, which were delicious. And then, so the smothered version, like the cheese kind of melted on top under the green chili. It was really, really good. I would definitely recommend if the listener is in Denver, check out the original Chubby's. Just don't eat anything beforehand. Don't make that mistake that I did.
I'm so hungry right now. We're going to have to pause this podcast. We'll drive 8 hours to In-N-Out.
And then watched the Seahawks game and went to the airport.
Okay.
So that was pretty much it.
It's funny because we, listening to the House of Carbs podcast, I constantly am making plans to have food weekends all of a sudden.
Yes. which are not realistic with your three small children.
I'm like, okay, so I'm going to Charleston for the weekend. Yep. I imagine all of these trips happening all alone. I'm actually planning them out in my mind, and I am not you, not anybody else. I'm just going
you're
on
not
my
taking
own.
Me? I thought I'm not invited?
For some reason, the way that I imagine it, I'm going on my own to Charleston and just eating.
Huh?
I'm not doing anything else.
No, I mean, that's the only reason to travel. Tourism is overrated.
So then you flew directly from Denver to LA.
Yes, to be on the jump on Monday, which was an eventful episode, to say the least, between the Melo trade, the Dwayne Wade buyout, and then, of course, the controversy over the president rescinding the Warriors' invitation to the White House over the weekend. And then players' commentary about that on Media Day.
And you didn't mention the Pelton cast in any of that?
I didn't. Didn't.
I can't even imagine.
The only local reference I had there was to the Seattle Storm going to the White House.
That's crazy. Oh, yeah. You did work in a Seattle reference.
There had to be something.
Because the thing we're going to be talking about in a second, very Seattle-focused.
Yes.
You had to get that in.
So after that, Mark Spears, who was on the Jump panel with me, and I drove me over to Lakers Media Day, which was taking place, it was starting pretty much simultaneously. And I did not interview anyone at Lakers Media Day, as it turns out, because that's not a place for me. But
okay,
mostly just hung out with and saw people friends of mine who are in LA, who I don't get this chance to see that often. It was nice to have everyone in, like, congregated in one place. But the important thing is, you know what the Lakers did for the media members at Media Day?
I'm like on the edge of my seat about this. What did they do?
They brought a burger truck.
Oh, really?
From Habit Burger. So Mark had noticed this, I guess, in the email we had gotten from Lakers PR. And so as we're driving there, we see the Habit Burger truck on the freeway with us. And he's like,
nice.
I bet that's going the same place that we are. And lo and behold, it was. So afterwards, free to media, they offered us a burger and fries.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Do they do that at other media days?
I think a lot. I think, like, there's... It
that was
like there's,
not happening at that Chicago Bulls media day.
It might have been. They might have been desperate to get people there. That was not a fixture at Sonics Media Day, to be sure. I think there's a little bit of more of a...
Sonics Media Day hasn't even happened since food trucks existed.
Well, that is definitely true. I think there's a little bit more of a battle, like, in terms of catering among the LA... Because I know, like, the Clippers will bring In-N-Out and stuff like that for the
really?
Members. Yeah.
And so you got Habit Burger.
I did, which was interesting because I hadn't tried it, and... You obviously had seen it, like me, had seen it in the Alaska Airlines terminal at LAX and had gone ahead and eaten it. So we've both, like, gotten Habit Burger in, like, not ideal climates, like not going to an actual restaurant.
I had a
restaurant.
Lot less ideal climate than you.
Yeah.
Okay, so the week before when I was coming back from LA, I'm in the airport and I'm walking along, hadn't eaten it all through the day, and then I saw, like, I didn't think that there would be any good food in the LA airport, which maybe there still wasn't. But
oh,
no, it's fine. But I didn't, you know, I wasn't expecting. It's not Seattle, right? There's no Beechers waiting around the corner.
There was a Mac and there was like a grilled cheese food truck in the American terminal, which I flew into
really?
On Sunday night.
Well,
it was no longer open, and I had eaten previously, as we talked about. I was not capable of eating at that point. But it looked very good.
It's such a big airport, though, that you have to get lucky.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah. You can only go to what's in your terminal.
So I stopped at, like, a Wolfgang Puck pizza place, right, and got a personal pizza, which actually was pretty good. But then I'm walking along holding my pizza, and I hadn't eaten it yet. I hadn't eaten anything all day, and it's, like, 3 o'clock. And I see that there's a Habit Burger, and I was like, that's not too expensive. So I also got a Habit Burger.
Oh, that's right, and you didn't eat it until after you got back to Seattle.
And then I put it in my bag. I'm not a monster, so I don't eat on airplanes.
Oh, you got to eat on airplanes. You know what I want? Let's see. What
the
is
smell
I, what
is so much for the people around you.
Yeah. You know,
when I'm on an airplane, I just try to suck into myself as much as I possibly can and not talk to anybody or bother anybody at all.
That's a good strategy. The only time I think I've eaten, like, a full-on meal on an airport was Tortas Frontera.
On an airplane.
Oh, on an airport? Tortas Frontera in O'Hare.
Yes.
Because I had such a short turnaround between flights that I, like, barely made it in the door. But I made a priority to get to Tortas Frontera and eat that on the plane.
So when I was flying to LA, I got the Beechers, and you're going to the end gates. You have to get on the little tram or whatever. I'm like, if I'm late, I will eat this on the plane.
Okay, that was the bridge you were willing to cross.
I also would have been very hungry. But so I got the Habit Burger. I shoved it in my backpack. I didn't eat it for the entire flight home, right? And then when I got to SeaTac, I had to wait a little bit for a ride. And I was like, I'm just going to eat this burger. And after sitting for probably about 3 hours,
it was wildly unsafe.
Still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, so my takeaway, I didn't love the onions that they had on it. I don't know how you felt about those.
You're anti-onion.
I'm okay with crisp onions. I don't like onions when they get like really kind of slimy. You know?
you should have them after 3 hours.
Yeah, seriously.
No, I didn't notice that the onions were slimy at all,
though. I thought the cheese was really good. I thought that was probably the strength. The patty was pretty meh. And then I would say the disappointment is that I think they only had mayo on it.
I'm so in on mayo on burgers.
I'm not out on mayo on burgers. I'm just saying I want more than mayo.
Okay.
I mean, we know your feelings about special sauce.
Yeah, I mean, you need a special sauce. So it only had mayo, huh?
I mean, there was like a ketchup there. I probably, if I had more time, could have added it, but...
But you want it on there. You don't have to be doing a lot of adding.
I agree.
I mean, the thing is, like...
So I would say it would not have been a top eight finisher, certainly, in the search for Seattle's best burger.
There's a Habit Burger probably 10 minutes from my house. Are you aware of this?
I don't think I was aware of that.
There's a Habit Burger by the Trader Joe's in Kent.
Okay. I also don't know where the Trader Joe's is.
You just drive that way. this great podcast stuff. But... I have never been there and really have not been that excited to go there and probably still will never go there.
All right. Fair enough. So that was my trip to LA. I also had some pretty good pizza, but that we don't need to get into.
So you've been to LA twice now. How many times? Three times?
No, twice. Three times. Yes, actually.
Wow. And you have not been to In-N-Out?
Yeah. I mean, it just hasn't really worked out.
Did you not see? I tweeted, I went to great lengths to get that In-N-Out.
I also have been to In-N-Out twice this year.
I suppose that's true.
You hadn't been in a full year, right?
Yeah, I'd been in a year. But if I go, let's say that I randomly go back to LA next week.
You're still going to In-N-Out?
I'm going back to In-N-Out. Yeah. I'm not going to be like, well, I've had my fill for the year.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I've had my fill.
The people of LA think it's very insane how excited people from Seattle are about eating In-N-Out.
Yeah, as they should.
Have you listened to the new Macklemore album?
I have. I've listened to it a few times today after giving it a first listen on Friday morning when it came out before I went on this extended trip.
Okay, so I felt like we should talk about this because it's, you know, it's a very important album for the city of Seattle. Basically, anytime that Macklemore puts something out, but...
A very important album for the city of Seattle.
Of course.
Macklemore is a very important artist for the city of Seattle, and it is a new album for him.
Wow, you're willing to say?
I just don't know that many albums are important for the city of Seattle anymore and since 1992.
Since what happened in 1992?
I mean, I'm just saying it's like the height of the grunge era. Those were some important albums for the city of Seattle. I mean, yes. Macklemore's breakthrough was important for the city.
Anyway,
that's not what we're here to discuss.
Did you have any thoughts on it?
I mean, I thought it was certainly much more enjoyable than his last album, which I don't think I've actually listened to more than one time in its entirety.
Wow.
So I'm already ahead of that.
I think somebody else said that to me, too.
Yeah.
That they listened to it one time. They're like, I'm good.
I could say I've done this. I probably listened to the songs as many times when we went to the Macklemore concert last year at Bumbershoot as on the album.
Wow. And so you felt like the new album Gemini, which we discussed previously, Macklemore no longer working with longtime producer Ryan Lewis, who he did the Versus EP, which is kind of the Macklemore breakthrough album, at least locally. It's what, you know, he ended up selling out the Showbox three nights in a row from. And then The Heist, which was the national breakthrough album.
Right.
And then the follow-up, This Unruly Mess I've Made, which you said you listened to one time.
He sure made it. And there are several songs on this album that I would say that I enjoy. I thought what was interesting about Gemini is like the diversity of the sound.
Okay.
From song to song, it's not necessarily a consistent sound. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of dependent to some extent on the guest contributor.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty good album, right?
Yeah.
I think if Macklemore had to do one thing, and it made sense, we talked about this, him not working with Ryan Lewis anymore, something had to change, right?
Yes.
The Certainly a Mess I've Made was not a successful album critically or commercially, and it was time for probably them to step away from each other for a little while.
I mean, I also think that probably either way, Macklemore is going to benefit from this album not being compared to The Heist, but being compared to Unruly Mess.
But I think the thing about it is, being without Ryan Lewis, he was able to not try to do too much. You know, every song doesn't have to be about something. You don't have to tackle the opioid issue in a song.
Right.
He can just record some music. And that's, to me, what it really felt like.
Sometimes
it's like,
you just want to get a little bout on a song. And
it's like you might be interested in just trying a Lil Yachty song, right? And you might be interested in trying Amigos song. And that's kind of what it feels like to me on this album. Is like he's just having fun making relatively fun music and kind of trying out some different styles and seeing how they work.
What is your favorite song off this album?
My favorite song on this album is the song Corner Store featuring Dave B and Travis Thompson.
Interesting.
Have you heard that song?
I mean, yes.
Did it stand out to you at all? It's kind of like this is his Chance the Rapper song.
But it doesn't actually feature Chance the Rapper like Unruly Mess.
No, because it kind of ruined the chance. Chance the Rapper. Look,
you ruined the chance? You blew the chance?
So think about this.
You're not going to acknowledge that pun.
He ruined the chance. Yes, I get it. On this Unruly Mess I Made, he had people like Chance. He had upcoming stars, right? He had Chance the Rapper on a song and didn't record a Chance the Rapper song.
Yes.
He had Anderson .Paak on the album and didn't record an Anderson .Paak song.
Which was a bad idea.
On Gemini, he has some local upstarts, which I think is great, having young Seattle artists being on a major album. But he has OTN O'Terry on the song Levitate doing basically an Anderson .Paak impression.
Okay.
Did that stand out to you at all?
No.
Listen again, you'll hear it.
All right.
And then on the song Corner Store, I think they even did the yeah, yeah, yeah thing from Chance the Rapper. I was like, okay, a little bit too far. But it's like this is their version of a Chance the Rapper song, which is fine. They're just doing stuff and trying it out and having a good time, right? Because to me, the main thing was that this album didn't feature songs that were so unlistenable that if I had to play the album, that I would fast forward through them, that I would click through the songs, right? Yeah. The song Kevin on the last album, I've heard one single time, not even the full song. And I love Leon Bridges. It's just like, why? What were you thinking?
My favorite song off this album so far is Ain't Gonna Die Tonight, which I don't know what it sounds like, but it sounds like something that, like, from the 70s or 80s that I like.
Yeah. Well, the lead singer's from the band Foxy Shazam, who are kind of like a throwback rock band.
Uh-huh.
But that's kind of like, there are a few songs where Macklemore isn't trying to do somebody else, and you're like, that's what Macklemore sounds like. And to me, that's one of them. And the song Glorious, which we talked about previously,
right,
which is definitely a standout song. And it's like, that is what Macklemore sounds like. Like, if you were to say this is his sound, that's it. And I think it works. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's perfect all around, but it's like, I like listening to Willy Wonka. It kind of sounds like a Migos song. I like listening to a lot of songs on it. And there are very few songs where it's like, this is a complete failure.
I would actually say that the weaker songs on this album might be better than the weaker songs on The Heist.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing, is like, Macklemore hasn't recorded a perfect album.
Yeah. I mean, there was so many jams on The Heist, but definitely a lot of filler as well.
The heights that they reached on The Heist were strong. There's just really some songs on there. So some things that I would have liked to have seen. First off, I think that it's a little bit surprising to me.
This is actually advice, because Macklemore is a listener to the pod, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That I would have liked to have seen some sort of political statement.
Right.
Right? Like, Macklemore's not an apolitical rapper. And it felt like he was so focused on just putting out kind of a carefree album that he didn't want to. It doesn't have to be white privilege too, but you can talk about politics right now.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is probably a reaction to Unruly Mess, and in some case, perhaps an overreaction.
But like the most overt political statement is Lil Boat, on the song. Lil Yachty has the most political statement on the song when he's... So I would have liked to have seen that. I also would have liked to have seen the return of motherfucking Raven Bowie, right? If this is your good time album, do you not know who that is?
Not really.
That's the Envy Dance character.
Oh, yeah.
In the intro to the Envy Dance video, they mentioned South Park also.
Do they?
Yeah, this was years ago. I'm sure it's not even available on the internet. But they mentioned South Park. And it's funny because at the time, it's like South Park is this crazy place.
Now it's so trendy.
So trendy. But I would have liked to have seen that. If you're making a Carefree album, bring back your character who puts out the jams. but otherwise, I think it's like when we see Macklemore in December at Key Arena, at a sold-out Key Arena.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited for that.
We're going to hear these songs and they're going to sound great.
Yeah.
Right? And that's really, I think, all that he needed to do with this album. It didn't have to be too much. You know, they tried a couple things out that don't quite work. As far as songs that don't work, the song Church, you're just like, okay, like, this is not your lane. Like, you realized you should stay in your lane and not go too far. You don't need to address every single issue. You don't need to end the consumerism that is around Nike, right?
Yes.
But you also are not Chance the Rapper. Like, just having that song in there is like, okay. Like, it's a nice attempt, but this is not who you are, Macklemore. But the misses are so far from the misses that they've done, that they've had previously.
Yeah.
That it's just like, I still enjoy listening to that song. It's not offensive to my ears, you know?
Right.
So I think in general, it's a good album. It's very listenable. I've listened to it 3 or 4 times. My children like it.
But as much as Kraftwerk?
Really, maybe as much as Kraftwerk. Now, maybe wow. Not quite to those heights, but...
Wow.
They're big... I mean, that's why I've listened to this on Really Best I Made so many times. You may have listened to it once, but I didn't have that privilege.
Yes, that's a good point.
So, I've listened to that album a lot.
What is... I can't remember now. I was going to tweet about this when I came across it on Friday. There's like an extraordinarily random NBA reference or basketball reference.
Extraordinarily random NBA reference.
There's an extremely random basketball reference.
He has a line about being in the pocket like Russell, and you're just like, Russell hasn't seen one of those in a while.
Oh, well.
Macklemore, you are in the pocket like Russell.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. I wish I could find what it is because it's so random. And I don't think it was on Genius yet. On Friday, I was listening to it, so I couldn't confirm that it was actually the lyric and that I wasn't just, you know, crazily making things up in my head.
I have not heard this random NBA reference.
I didn't catch it today. So maybe I was crazy on Friday. I don't know. Or someone else can point it out to us on Twitter, and I will be appreciate that. All right, should we get to sports?
Yeah, was there any news on... We've been covering the arena situation closely. Was there any news?
Not really any news this past week. Actually, pretty quiet, I would say, after all the drama of the previous week with the release of the Key Arena MOU. So, as part of the MOU, they have begun work on an environmental impact study about the Key Arena renovation, which is necessary to begin construction. And there will be a public meeting on the Key Arena proposal scheduled for Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Seattle Armory. The first step in compiling an EIS, this is from the description, is soliciting public impact to determine the range of topics to be reviewed within the environmental document. This process is known as scoping. SDCI has identified the following areas for discussion in the EIS: traffic and transportation, historic preservation, landmarks and archaeological resources, light and glare, noise, land use, and public services and facilities.
Light and glare?
Yeah, I guess I don't know if there's bright lights. Like the light of the Key Arena sign is a light polluted, I guess, is what I would say. So this isn't...
I'm going to go there and just complain about the light and glare of Key Arena.
That sounds like a great idea. This is like, as I was saying, just to determine the scope of the EIS. It wasn't really a place to go and make your opinion about SOTO versus Key Arena known. As we've talked about in the past, that's still October 10th, that meeting of the city council at night, which again is opposite the trivia we're hosting.
Maybe that's why the people are just interested.
Exactly. They're not sure whether they can make it to both. But that's pretty much it. We'll see if we have more on that front over the next week.
And what about the Sounders this week? Suffering a... Yes, their first loss in a long time.
A long time, since June. The unbeaten streak snapped at 13 with a 2-0 loss at Real Salt Lake. And now the second consecutive match the Sounders have gone scoreless since Jordan Morris's hamstring injury. And he remains sidelined by that injury. Won't be back for this Wednesday's game against Vancouver. Almost certainly not for Sunday's game at Philadelphia. After that, there's an international break. And, you know, maybe one of the last two matches of the regular season, which, believe it or not, is drawing near its conclusion.
You've got to work in an international break in between there, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's necessary. So the Sounders have dropped to fourth in the Western Conference now, three points back. They're only one win back of the two teams tied for second in the Western Conference. Their chances of first round bye, according to the Soccer Power Index on 538, have dropped to 21%. And they pretty much have to win on Wednesday when they're hosting the Whitecaps, who now lead the Western Conference, despite the fact that, amazingly, they have a negative expected goal differential this season, according to American Soccer Analysis and estimates. Whereas the Sounders continue, despite their loss on Saturday, to have the best expected goal differential in MLS.
That is insane.
It really is.
Because when I look at this team, I mean, I wasn't able to see this game because it was
basically completely opposite the Husky game. It started a half hour beforehand.
But when I look at this team, in the matches that I have seen before this, the draw after draw after draw, and then this 2-0 loss, this is not a team that's actually competing for the MLS Cup.
I mean, when they were at their best in the month of July and early August, they were playing well enough to do that.
So for the Sounders this year, last year it was kind of a tale of two seasons. They were bad, and then they were good. This year, they were bad, then they were good, and now they're kind of eh.
Yeah, I mean, first off, they need to get Jordan Morris back. They've really struggled to create chances without him, particularly on the
road.
Even
with Jordan Morris, though.
But yeah, I mean, you still have Clint Dempsey. You know, you still have playmakers. You should be more effective offensively. You know, Nicolas Lodeiro and Dempsey and maybe Victor Rodriguez should be the shell of a stronger attack than we've seen. And this Wednesday back home is the game they have to get going and create more chances.
I mean, we said that last week against Real Salt Lake, that would be the week that the offense would get going, and then they're shut out.
Yep. That's about right.
Ugh.
And they weren't necessarily that hard done by to be shut out. I mean, I think they were a little hard done by to give up a couple goals. Certainly the impact of Tryde Marshall, who's missed the last two matches with a hamstring strain of his own, has been felt. He, it sounds like, could be back on Wednesday for this match against Vancouver. And always feel much more comfortable with Marshall is the air marshal in the middle of the defensive back line. So the Sounders have won and drawn so far this season against Vancouver, playing both of those matches north of the border. This will be Freddie Montero's first trip to CenturyLink Field as a visitor, the all-time Sounders leading scorer, who has scored all three goals for Vancouver against the Sounders
really?
This season. Yeah,
they've all come from Freddie Montero. Yep. Every game is a Freddie Montero revenge game.
Every single game. So obviously shutting him down, very important for this one.
Yes.
The Cascadia Cup also on the line on Wednesday night, as the Sounders need a victory to have a chance to win the Northwest Trophy. And if they do
win... Is there an actual trophy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a cup. I feel like the Sounders have it, but I would probably need to double check that to be sure. If they win, they actually have a pretty good chance of winning the Cascadia Cup, because the only remaining match among those three teams would be Portland playing at Vancouver on decision day, the final day of the regular season.
You know, I've always said, all I care about is the Cascadia Cup.
Yeah.
That's what we're playing for.
Let's say that if the Sounders win on Wednesday. So on Sunday, they travel across the country to Philadelphia for an early, it'll be a 1 p.m. local kickoff, 10 a.m. Seattle kickoff on ESPN. Philadelphia, another team that has a negative expected goal differential, pretty similar to the Whitecaps, but the difference is they have the record to go with that and have effectively been eliminated from playoff contention in the Eastern Conference. So, you know, this is a match that I think the Sounders probably need to salvage at least a point from.
I mean, across the board between these two matches, they have to come out with at least 2 points.
I would say this has got to be a 4-point week for them.
And they have to win a match.
Win a match and get a draw you know, get a result in both matches in order to stay in contention for one of the two first round buys in the Western Conference.
We're at the point where we should stop talking about their win streak or their not losing streak that happened and start talking about their not winning streak.
Which is now five matches. If you do the, you know, the recent form is traditionally in soccer, the last five matches, and that's all draws and then a loss for the Sounders. Whereas for the Whitecaps, I believe it's four wins and a draw in their last five matches. They're coming in extremely hot.
Let's talk about something more positive.
Yeah.
Man! Oh, this Husky game. I am so fired up about this.
You really are. You were
there. Fired. You should be a lot
I'm
more fired
not
up.
Fired up about it. I'm just not as fired. So we definitely exchanged text during the first quarter saying that the Huskies were going to lose.
Before the first quarter. We exchanged text leading into this game. So let's talk about the injuries first.
Yeah, okay, because that was part of the reason that we were so concerned is because yes. During my flight to Boulder on Friday night, I learned that Byron Murphy has broken the fifth metatarsal in his foot and is out for 6 weeks. And that's a rough one because of the fact that the fifth metatarsal injury is one that has a tendency to recur.
I mean, that's a good chunk of the Pac-12 season.
It is. Now, the good news is the Huskies... they just coach up cornerbacks, and it's just yes. Fine.
The Huskies actually are what people think the Seahawks are.
Yes. I mean, Shaquille Griffin has played quite well. I don't know if we're going to get into that in the CX section. But, yeah, I mean, you know, these are three new starters already, and now you trot out a fourth, and, really no drop-off, I would say, whatsoever. Byron Murphy wasn't there to intercept passes, so lo and behold, Jordan Miller comes up with two interceptions, and Miles Bryant, the third, and runs that back for a pick six.
And Miles Bryant! I mean, it was unbelievable.
It was a really impressive performance by the secondary.
But wait, we need to talk about the other injuries.
Okay, so LaVon Coleman does not make the trip to Colorado because of a concussion.
We kind of correct, like, this is going to be an important game for the Husky ground attack.
Yep. Dead on that one.
And it was, but it just meant that all of that weight went on to Myles Gaskin.
Yes. Career high number of carries, correct?
Feature back Myles Gaskin.
Yeah.
Which I can't wait until he's a second round pick in the NFL and is a monster fantasy player.
That sounds about right.
Okay, so those two injuries happen. Plus,
and then Andre Bocelli not making the road trip, his second consecutive game that he's missed. That injury is still undisclosed. And credit to Adam Jude of the Seattle Times for reporting all of this on Friday night. But
it all kind of came out of nowhere, though, right? Like, this hit us.
We just hadn't been thinking about the Andre Bocelli injury, I guess I would say.
But the Coleman and Byron Murphy injuries kind of came out of nowhere.
For sure. And, you know, the team doesn't talk about injuries generally, so...
It's hard. Like we talk about how we probably pay too much attention to the Seahawks. It's hard to pay that much attention to the Huskies because the information is so sparse.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still some of the information, but certainly on injuries, it's much scarcer.
But so, okay, let's set the picture here. Going into Saturday night, you have those injuries, right? Byron Murphy, who we felt great about. LaVon Coleman, who we expected to have a big game. Then there are kind of upsets throughout college football on Saturday. Plus, we find out that it's been pouring rain all day. And teams from Seattle are bad at playing in the rain.
We didn't find out. Some of us were well aware.
You found out firsthand. But there were people, I was watching College Game Day, and I think it was Kirk Herbstreit or somebody who was saying...
It was so negative. It was weird. It was like, wait a second. This is a 12.5-point favorite, and like all the talk is doom and gloom?
It felt very negative across the board. We went into this game saying, this is a trap game.
I took offense to that. I didn't tweet about this from the Pelton Cast account. You can't have a trap game before you're playing Oregon State. A trap game is when you play a relatively weaker opponent the week before you play a big opponent.
That's
definition of a trap game.
Narrow vision of what a trap game is.
This is just a difficult game.
Okay. How about that? Like, this is going in. We knew this was a difficult game.
Yes.
And I think people are probably... And maybe now I don't have this perspective, but I'm thinking of myself on Saturday. Think underrating Colorado. The fact that they won the Pac-12 South a year ago, were undefeated this year, and were 12.5-point underdogs at home?
Well, it turned out to be accurate because they had lost a significant amount of talent on both quarterback and then, you know, throughout their throughout the defensive side of the football.
Just edit those out.
And while the defense generally played, yeah, they had their moments. And it's interesting because the offense was like very successful in matriculating the ball down the field for much of the first half, but they actually weren't generating that much yardage, really. And that eventually caught up with them in addition to the three interceptions.
Coach Pete doesn't allow for trap games.
Exactly. Like, look, he was coaching in a place in Boise State where they literally had to win every game to accomplish their goals.
There's no coach who I would rather have in the country preparing this team for that game.
I mean, Nick Saban is still very good at that sort of thing. But yeah,
I would rather have Nick Saban in a lot of other facets, but preparing this team to go to Colorado to play a feisty, can we call them that? What can we call Colorado? Maybe after this weekend we can call them bad. But
no, I don't think. I mean, they're not bad. I mean, look, the Huskies are just really good at football.
The Huskies are a team that we didn't really know what they were going into this game. We thought there was a chance that maybe they were a pretty good team, but they wouldn't be able to reach the heights that they reached last year. And now
they look certainly capable of doing it. I mean,
there's no roof for what this team can accomplish.
I mean, you look at their rankings in the ESPN Football Power Index team efficiencies, which are, you know, the FPI includes basically your prior based on past seasons. The team efficiencies are only based on this season's performance. Number 4 in offense, number 15 in defense, number 1 in special teams. If your worst unit is 15th best in the country,
there can't be many teams who are better than that, right?
I mean, they're still number 5, I think, in terms of the team efficiency. Or maybe that's FPI. They might be a little higher in team efficiency.
But again, this is a top 5 team in the country.
Yeah.
Legitimately. And we didn't really know what we had going in. And after this win, remember the last year's, the first Pac-12 road game?
Yes. I remember last year.
This didn't look anything like that. This is a team.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're number 2 in team efficiency after Alabama.
Yeah. I'll say it right now. Bring on Bama.
No, that never ends well. Why would you say that?
It ended pretty well for Clemson.
Fair.
But this game changed my entire perspective about what this Husky team is. Well, and that's why
perhaps,
I think...
Perhaps your previous perspective was whack.
Wow. I couldn't respect that.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. We talked to Mike last week, and he said he wasn't concerned about Colorado. And after that first drive, I was like, what was he thinking?
That wasn't my thought at that point, weirdly. Huh?
And then for the rest of the game, the Huskies really, I mean, it took some turnovers, and it took some big plays on offense.
But they outscored the Colorado 37-3 after the first drive.
It was
37-3
that they were the better team in every single facet of the game.
I mean,
with the block on special teams, yeah. Unfortunately, Dante Pettis wasn't able to take one back.
I mean, what a disappointment. What's even the point?
Yeah, kind of just a bad game all around. But the block on special teams, the interceptions, Jake Browning being able to hit these huge plays. I mean, Quentin Pounds in relief with a touchdown going up and getting it.
And so that's big news because the disappointing aspect of this game at Colorado is Chico McClatcher breaking his ankle in what by all accounts was ugly to see in terms of the play. Obviously did not see anything like that in the stadium.
Go to a party on Saturday night, so I had to start driving at like 5 minutes into the third quarter. And so I just heard it be described on the radio. Damon Heward was taken aback.
Yeah. We just saw the cart coming back, and even though they didn't actually use it, and then saw him eventually get wheeled off in a wheelchair. And
season, so you could probably understand it was pretty brutal.
I mean, I understood at that point that he was likely out for the season. I'm saying those were the context clues. So, you know, we'll see about Bocelli. It's not considered a long-term injury, is the reporting from Jude on that. But, you know, I think you'd... You don't necessarily need him back for this week and maybe not necessarily some of the next couple of weeks, but at some point he's going to have to be a part of this. And yeah, it's really on guys like Quentin Pounds, Aaron Fuller, and then Hunter Bryant, I think, stepping into a larger role.
But I think in Savon.
Well, yeah, that's the other aspect is because, you know, Chico McClatcher is not exactly a traditional going to go up and get the ball in traffic receiver. He is really that threat on end arounds,
option plays, you know, smoke option plays the line of scrimmage, that sort of thing. And that's where Ahmed can sort of replace the speed that he brings to that position.
But I think we feel pretty confident in their ability to replace Chico McClatcher. I mean, this is not a devastating injury for the Huskies.
It doesn't worry me, but, you know, there is a cumulative effect of losing as many wide receivers as they have at this point. So, by the way, we should shout out that Austin Joyner, in his first action, or not his first action, he returned the previous week against Fresno State, but his first extended action, really stepping in tremendously for Murphy there as a starter.
I mean,
in
addition
to the other guys stepping up.
I chatted to you at the end of the second quarter, right? Colorado, the clock is ticking down, and Colorado refused to pass the ball, and it looked like maybe in the second half they were right to do so.
Right.
But this was an offense that was not prepared in any way to try to test this secondary, which is full of newcomers across the board and is a testament to how well they have this team prepared.
So speaking of unprepared to test the
Huskies. Oh, no. Well, anyway, I just want to say, this Colorado game was huge. And when you look at the schedule going forward, it feels like the Huskies really don't play that many road games. I mean,
no,
they end
true.
The season with, I think, five at home.
They play five road games, including Rutgers. But
two of them are down, and one of them is Oregon State.
So about Oregon State. Mentioned earlier the Huskies ranking fifth in the country in FPI. You know where Oregon State ranks?
Oh, no, where?
103rd. The second worst FPI for any Power 5 school, ahead of only Kansas, which, bad news for Kansas. And they will be without their starting quarterback, Jake Luton, who suffered a thoracic spine fracture, which apparently is not as bad as it sounds, because that sounds horrible.
Does he have the nickname Shootin' Luton? Doesn't work in football.
He suffered that in the fourth quarter at Wazoo. He has been ruled out for this week. And senior,
did they play? They played Wazoo last week?
2 weeks ago. They had a bye last week. Senior Daryl Garrison will get the start this week. Garrison started six games last season, but had already been sidelined due to the injury by the time the Huskies beat the Beavers last year. With Garrison stepping into the starting lineup, and really either way, the Beavers will probably want to rely heavily on the run game. And their running back, Ryan Nall, has been pretty solid this season, averaging 6.1 yards per carry. But that's really the most notable thing about the Beavers. They are ranked, going back to the team efficiencies in Football Power Index, they are ranked 94th in offense, 94th on defense, 120th on offense, and 72nd on special teams.
That's almost like 4th, 15th, and 1st, right?
The thing is, there's not that many more than 120 teams in Division I in the FBS. There are only 130. You're 120th out of 130 on offense.
Oh, my God.
So things not going much better this season at Oregon State. It's fair to say. Wait, did I get that backwards? Are they 120? I think they are 120th in defense, and I don't know.
Well, either way, no matter what they are, this is a game that the Huskies should dominate in every single facet.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And I mean, the spread is 27.5, which feels about right.
Yeah, they are 94th in offense, 120th in defense, and yes. This, in some ways, an extension of the non-conference season, I think, in all likelihood.
Wow.
Chances of victory?
95%.
Yeah, FBI goes with 97%. That's what I'm going to go with as well. One other note while we're on the college section of this, a pretty shocking news story coming out Tuesday is the FBI announced the indictments of four assistant coaches, including two in the Pac-12, Arizona's Emmanuel Richardson and USC's Tony Bland, on charges they took cash bribes to funnel players to agents and financial advisors. And the charges also allege that family of players.
Financial advisors like Spencer Strassmore?
No, Spencer Strassmore's keeping it clean.
I'm not saying him personally.
Yes,
but
yes, like that. So this is kind of the tip of the iceberg, it sounds like. There was a report that NBA agent Andy Miller, who employed one of the agents who was implicated in this scheme.
No relation to Arizona's coach, I'm assuming?
No. had his computer seized today as the FBI continues to investigate how far kind of this thing goes. And, you know, we all know about the seedy underbelly of college sports. And I do think one thing I hope for, I mentioned this on Twitter on Tuesday, is that people don't get really obsessed with, you know, kind of the, oh, what kind of punishment is there going to be against Arizona and USC? Or like making it out to be, oh, these bad apples on these assistant coaches or, you know, these agents or financial advisors. It is not about individual schools. It is not about individual people. It is about a corrupt system that does not allow players to recognize their value. And if they're going to do it, they have to go on the black market. And until the NCAA fixes that, changes its philosophy entirely, this problem will never go away, no matter how many FBI investigations, no matter how many punishment you level, because the fear of getting caught is not enough. It's got to be, you've got to fix your broken system.
And what do you mean by that?
That players aren't allowed to, they're first off not allowed, of course, to make money from the schools, which they should because they're bringing in revenue, but they're also prohibited from, you know, going out and getting outside endorsements or dealing above the board with agents, you know, while they're in school, which is, you know, the Olympic model, you know, that you can have outside endorsements even if you're not directly getting paid. Well, you can now get paid in the Olympics, but, you know, still the NCAA is so far beyond every other organization in the world on this. And it's just shocking that it's allowed to, been allowed to continue. One of my favorite parts from the charging documents was there was there's a reference to the NCAA's guidelines about, you know, not wanting exploitation of student athletes, which is cool because only they are allowed to exploit student athletes.
That's their mission statement.
Yep.
But no, I mean, I totally agree with you. I wouldn't hold my breath that that's going to be what happens.
I mean, I'm not saying that the NCAA, I mean, look, I obviously in an ideal world, I want the NCAA to think that. Mark Ebert's statement, our old friend Mark Ebert, indicated nothing of that whatsoever.
Shocking.
Yeah. I'm talking out from the media because there's such a tendency to get carried away of like, what can we investigate? Like, what can we uncover? And the focus is all on, you know, who broke rules? What's the punishment? And it's not on who's the actual victim here,
yes,
which is the student athletes. The victim here is not the team that doesn't cheat.
Yeah.
The competitive balance is not the concern that college sports should have, because that's not the point of college sports. The point of college sports is to benefit the student athletes, not to provide entertainment for you and me. So,
man, I was going to give a take, but I feel like I shouldn't after that.
What's your take?
My take was that I feel like focusing on these assistant coaches, which I grant this might just be the first step to what's happening.
It's definitely just the first step.
But focusing on these assistant coaches doesn't make any sense because no assistant coach is operating outside of the system of what the head coach and what the university wants.
I mean, I would say in
this case, Pac-12 coaches deciding, being like, I'm going rogue.
I mean, if you're familiar with, if you understand the allegations, it's not really about, you know, paying players to come to your school. That's part of the allegations against Adidas.
Okay.
Which is also a part of this story that we haven't really gotten into. The allegations against these coaches are them individually taking money to direct players to specific agents and financial advisors. So it's not, I don't think, something that the head coaches necessarily would have knowledge of.
I still think that the schools are implicated here. Like if they're,
I mean, the schools are implicated in terms of the fact that the players are getting paid off as well, and that's where the violations occur. But I don't think it's necessarily fair to expect the head coaches to know that their assistant coaches are doing this.
Are pushing players to an individual agent.
Because you could be pushing players to an agent for perfectly legitimate reasons.
Yes.
So, the system's broken.
Well.
And I didn't know we were going to get to grievances early, but there, I think we kind of did. But, now let's do it for real.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
I can't believe it has to be said that the Seahawks losing to Tennessee was not a result of the time they spent Saturday afternoon discussing their response to President Trump's demeaning and profane criticism of NFL players who kneel for the national anthem. But if replies to Bob Condotta on Twitter are to be believed, there is a small segment of Seahawks fans who sees a connection between those two things. And that's disappointing for a couple of reasons. The first is the tendency for fans to see athletes exclusively as players and not as human beings. Any extracurricular activity, whether it's taking up blogging or dating a famous musician, is seen as somehow distracting players as if they spend every waking moment finished solely on playing football. Not even Russell Wilson does that. The second thing that bothers me here is the notion that football is more important than, you know, dealing with these protests. Yes, playing football is what players are paid to do, but would you say that your job is the single most important thing in your life? The role that Seahawks players and other athletes have taken in creating a discussion about race and justice in the United States is something that has the potential to long outlast wins and losses in what's ultimately a game. Frankly, the Seahawks lost because they were on the road, and they're a worse football team right now than the Tennessee Titans. We can and will discuss why that's the case, but nothing about the final outcome on Sunday was surprising given that the Titans were favored going into the game. So don't blame it on what happened Saturday afternoon at the team hotel.
Okay, so I guess we're getting into this right now.
We are getting into it.
Right? But what did you make of the Seahawks' response to Trump's comments?
I mean, I think first off, one of the unfortunate things about what's happened with the protests in the NFL, with anthem protests, is that it becomes kind of like a discussion of, you know, the nuts and bolts of it, as opposed to the actual meaning of what players are trying to protest and, you know, the message that they have.
Yes.
So at the same time, it felt like, in the wake of what President Trump said, if you didn't do something, you were almost acquiescing to what he said.
Uh-huh.
So
I heard George Sedano told me.
It's unfortunate that, you know, I thought Howard Bryant made this point while I saw him on SportsCenter on Monday, that now instead of protesting actual issues, you're protesting the right to protest.
Yes.
But you almost have been forced to do that.
It's a free speech issue, but okay.
It is an actual issue, but it doesn't allow a... It's moved backwards from protesting for something else to just protesting for the sake of protesting.
You mean the idea that where this kneeling for the anthem started to where it is now has been so construed?
Misconstrued?
Yes. It's been so misconstrued. The entire last football season it was, but especially now, where it started as, for all we know, Colin Kaepernick protesting police brutality against African Americans.
Yes.
It's something that we saw with one of the players on the Seahawks happen to them personally.
Yes.
It is a huge issue that's happening. And all of a sudden, now it has turned into a race issue and it's turned into a supporting the military issue.
Right.
Things that were not involved at all. And it's turned into a free speech issue. Things that were not involved with what Colin Kaepernick was talking about.
I mean, these are efforts to distract you from the real message. I will say the real
message here is that these players were protesting the president's words over the weekend, which were a free speech issue, but also they were protesting, and I think this is what Pete Carroll kind of touched on, having some sort of empathy and understanding where everybody is coming from, right?
And that's the thing for me, is more important than whatever the Seahawks do during the anthem is the messages that they continue to share throughout the week. So, you know, Michael Bennett, Richard Sherman, Pete Carroll, them in particular, but, I think Doug Baldwin certainly as well, you know, for them to continue to express their messages as eloquently and as thoughtfully as they have is more important, I think, than the anthem itself.
Yes. And from the Seahawks' perspective, I would have liked to have seen a stronger statement, both from the team. So seeing Peter McLaughlin come out with a statement that felt a little bit weak, honestly, considering that he's representing a team in the Seahawks who have a lot of outspoken players, players like Michael Bennett, who has experienced this more firsthand than almost any other player in the NFL.
Yes.
But then also on behalf of an owner who is not one of the owners who have donated to Trump, right? I would have liked to have seen a stronger statement from Paul Allen.
And I think this was a situation where a stronger statement would have been welcomed, I think, by the fan base.
We'll see about that. I want to talk about that in 1 second. But I would have liked to have seen a stronger statement from them. But then also, the staying in the locker room for the anthem, it's a statement, but there's nothing visual about it.
I think there is something visual about it. The empty sideline is visual.
I think that players kneeling or not standing is more visual than players not being present.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't think we should get bogged down in that part of the debate.
which is whatever, fine. But I thought that the individual players, Doug Baldwin won, who had one of the best statements of any players there were, right? Pete Carroll, who was very supportive. And I think that's part of the reason that I think maybe the Seahawks gave kind of a bland statement.
Yeah, they don't need to.
They wanted to leave it to the players.
Yeah.
They didn't want to speak on behalf of the players. I would like to hear from Paul personally, but I think it makes sense for them to let the players speak for themselves because they can.
Exactly. And can speak to this, you know, with much more personal, much more personally than Peter McLaughlin can on behalf of the organization.
Yes. But I do think about it. And I think about if Paul Allen were an owner like Robert Kraft, who had gone to the White House, given a championship ring to President Trump, I would feel uncomfortable with that. I would feel uncomfortable with that as a Seahawks fan, especially given these comments. I mean, beforehand, I would have pretty much completely, but it would have been even more exacerbated by these comments.
I mean, President Trump basically took aim at the NFL as an entirety.
Man. And it's like he is one of the few owners who really has ground to stand on through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would have liked to have seen something stronger from him. But if I were a Patriots fan right now, I would be feeling very mixed about my feelings about cheering for that team. And so when we head into this weekend's games where we see a home game, we don't know what the Seahawks are going to do. My hunch is they'll probably be in the locker room again. And if I'm there in my seat by the time the anthem is happening, which the chances of that are around zero, but if I'm in my seat, I personally will not be standing for the anthem. And if people are booing people around them not standing or booing the players, which apparently happened throughout the NFL, I'll be very disappointed in Seahawks. I'll be disappointed in them for both not understanding what this team is about and why we cheer for this team, which is something we've talked about, but then also not supporting the right to having whatever response you'd like.
To peaceful protest.
Yes.
Should we talk about Sunday's game?
Yeah, last Sunday's game?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this one. After having watched from, you were watching at a bar.
Yeah, I don't feel like I got quite as good a perspective as I normally would, you know, with the ability to rewind and use Twitter as a second screen much more effectively.
The Titans were offsides on every play.
I read that. I would say that I feel a little bit better about things reviewing the statistics after the fact. I was kind of prepared to come today with the take that I'm concerned that, you know, the fact that there's such a narrative around the Seahawks start slow and they improve over the course of the season that, you know, it could blind us to when they eventually do decline significantly, that we're going to be late on discovering that.
No.
But
I mean, we are, but that's not what's happening.
As I look at the stats, I mean, the Seahawks offense really has not actually been that bad. Without opponent adjustments, the offense ranks better by DVOA than the defense does. 17th in Football Outsiders DVOA as compared to 18th for the defense.
I guess I'm
and 22nd not for the special teams. The offense is currently rated as the best Seahawks unit. That's, again, before opponent adjustments.
I think I'm not that surprised by that.
And you shouldn't be, because the offense was amazing in the second half of that. After the yes. After starting with 6 points, given that start,
well, they were really the quite second good half after plus one.
Yes. So the other thing I looked up is the Seahawks yards per play by down using Pro Football Reference.
Okay, I'm curious to hear this.
On first down, they averaged 6.1 yards per play, which ranks 9th in the league. On second down, they averaged 4.6 yards per play, which ranks 26th in the league. On third down, do you want to guess how many?
Oh, my God. 2.8.
That's a very good guess. 2.7, which ranks 30th in the league. On third and on plays of where they have faced third down in more than 7 yards, or at least 7 yards, I should say, they've had 23 of those plays, which ties for the second most in the league, and that's not good. But they've averaged 1.9 yards per play on them, which is worst in the NFL, and they have just 3 first downs, which is the fourth worst percentage.
Do you think that's because the line can't hold up when defenses know that they can tee off on them?
I mean, there hasn't necessarily been a lot of sacks in that situation. Certainly, that's a factor in it. But the Seahawks have also had a shocking number of drops. Or even catchable balls that haven't been caught.
It's been very strange.
Were not an issue whatsoever in past seasons. And, you know, that was when Jermaine Kearse was on the team.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So
that checks out.
I can only conclude that it was because of Jermaine Kearse. He didn't have quite as good a game last week. after you picked him up in fantasy, right?
He wasn't bad.
Yeah. I think Robbie Anderson was the go-to guy, though, for the Jets last week. So, you know, it does seem like there's significant area of potential for making the Seahawks making regression to the mean work for them. You know, one of the things Football Outsiders has found in the past, though, is that when teams perform much better on first and second down than third down, you know, naturally that tends to regress to the mean. And then third down has an outsized impact. So, yeah, I mean, if you perform much worse on first down than second and third, that would regress to the mean too, but it probably wouldn't matter as much as third down because that's how you extend drives. That's how you avoid punting.
Does that regress to the mean within a season or year to year?
Both. I mean, the strength of the regression to the mean is not going to be as strong within a season as it is over the next year because, you know, you've still got that those games factored into it, basically. I mean, I think, you know, still the conclusion is the same as it has been, that the Seahawks are focusing too much on trying to establish a run and playing this power run game that, despite Chris Carson's ability to break tackles, is not appropriate for their offensive line at this point. And they're definitely at their best when they let Russell Wilson go out there and make plays.
Yes.
Despite some misses in the first half from him.
Do you think that was the case in this game, though?
That they were at their best when they let him out, go out there and make plays?
Well, obviously that. But do you think they were focusing too much energy on trying to establish the run?
I mean, it's interesting because they didn't run the ball necessarily that much in the first half. They had ran nine times as compared to 17 passes, I think, was the breakdown in the first half. The two-minute drill affects that a little bit. But other than the one drive, the much maligned drive where they ran three times and punted, which I didn't have much of a problem with because the first two runs gained 9 yards, and then third and one, it is probably the right call to run in that situation. Just spread it out a little bit instead of putting 10 guys within the box at the line of scrimmage, as we've lamented in the past.
God, any time that they've telegraphed a run, they have not been good in like the last 5 years.
It is weird. They have been more successful running on third down than I thought. They're 4 of 7 in terms of picking up third downs.
Really?
First downs on third down when they run. Although some of those might be Russell Wilson scrambles. I'm not sure how many of those were, actually.
What do we make of both Thomas Rawls and Eddie Lacy being active and getting one carry between the two of them?
I mean, Chris Carson is better than them. And
not even a carry.
One play.
One
no
play care. Between the two of them.
Chris Carson's better than them, and CJ Procise brings a complementary skill set. And as long as they're healthy, I don't really see a need for Rawls or Lacy to be that involved at this point.
But why were they active?
I guess I'm not sure.
Yeah, that was kind of a baffling one. But when you look at the stats overall at the end of the game, I mean, Russell Wilson passed the ball 49 times. I wanted to air grievances that the offense that they had in the second half is the offense. But then I look at it statistically, and while that's true, I don't know if they weren't necessarily trying to do that in the first half.
Yeah.
It's not like they were like pounding the ball into the line over and over and over again in the first half.
They weren't, but just pounding the ball into the line at all for not much yardage is just not a good idea.
I mean, I believe this is my vision of offense, is that you should always pass.
Yeah.
And occasionally you should run.
Yes.
And I feel like that's what they were trying to do. They weren't trying to pound the ball on the line. I mean, like, you look at most of the drives, and they were passing 2 out of 3 times almost every drive.
Well, if you're running on second, if you've got incompletion and then run on 2nd and 10, that's not generally a recipe for success.
Well, that should never happen, but it was still pretty rare for them.
I mean, that happens all the time.
It didn't happen that much in this game. I'm saying I think that this game was called pretty well, all things considered. I do not think that very much of the blame in this game lays on the shoulders of the offense, as you said.
I mean, the fact that the defense was on the field as much as it was, surely a factor in them wearing down in the second half, particularly with the unprecedented heat in Tennessee for a football game.
Oh, God. But
somehow I went to the place where it was 50 degrees in September for a football game instead of going to the place where it was 90 degrees, which would have been too hot, in fairness.
Yes. But I think part of that was just kind of random chance. You know, for whatever reason, they didn't get the offense going as quickly as they would have liked to. But when it got going, it looked good.
It did.
And most games, if the offense moves as good as it did, they're going to win those games.
Well, assuming the defense is as good as it's been historically.
Most of the time, if the Seahawks score 27 points, they are going to win.
Yeah. I mean, here's the other thing that we have to ask about. The Tennessee offensive line is phenomenal.
Yes.
Looked every bit the part. Are we concerned at all that the Seahawks aren't getting that much pass rush?
That's another grievance that I have. I mean, we went on and on and on about these four pass rushers. And it's like, I was saying at the end of the game, they showed Cliff Avril, and I was like, I forgot that he was on the team. I mean, I'm not going to say that Cliff Avril's necessarily having a bad season, but seems kind of non-existent. Like, there's the ageless Michael Bennett. He's on another level. Sean Richardson made some plays, but where was Cliff Avril and Frank Clark in this game?
And these are all places where, again, I think that the gotta be patient. Sometimes you can be too patient from a Bayesian standpoint. Like, the Seahawks ceiling has decreased significantly from where it was at the start of the season.
Mm,
and also the LA Rams might be good. They might be good. The Seahawks winning the FC West should not be taken for granted or anything close to it.
Not getting any pressure in this game, though, it was shocking. I mean, considering what they have invested in this defensive line, it was shocking that they only had, I think, one hurry in the entire game.
Sounds about right. And then the other thing that happened...
And it came from Garrison Smith?
Yeah. The other thing that happened is the special teams was bad again. Although, in this case, perhaps somewhat predictable because of the fact that you're already playing without Nico Thorpe and DJ Alexander, two of your top special teamers, and then you lose Dewey McDonald on the opening kickoff with a torn ACL that will end his season. So,
man,
that
the more that I think about this, all the Seahawks have is Russell Wilson. It's kind of crazy that
they also have Doug Baldwin, assuming that he's able to, he left obviously with a groin injury, but told KJR's Ian Furness on Tuesday that he anticipates playing this week.
Which, again, Mike said last week as his grievance was that the offense should run through Doug Baldwin.
It sure did.
And it did, and it was great when it did. But I'm not willing to jump that far at the defense. They looked very good for the first six drives that Tennessee had.
Yeah, you know when they looked very good? When... A, they were stopping the run really well. But
yes.
Also, B, Tennessee was trying to run too much at that point, too.
Yes.
And they started passing on early downs, and suddenly their offense got a lot more effective. Should we talk about the Colts?
No, I want to talk about Tennessee more.
What?
Because didn't it look good, even though it was because of the situation that the Seahawks were down and needing to pass and needing to hurry up? Wasn't it just nice to see the offense moving?
Yeah. Obviously, it was nice to see that.
I mean, I'm...
It was nice to see Jimmy Graham involved with the offense. That was cool.
The way... So you kind of critiqued the idea that they needed to open up the offense.
I critiqued the idea that they need to play fast.
What's the difference? What does it mean? What does opening up the offense mean? Is it... Like, does opening... I've thought about this a lot. And does opening up the offense... There's basically two options.
Not focusing on a power run game.
Does opening up the offense mean passing?
Yes.
Okay. Which is hilarious to think that that's what it means.
Yeah.
Or does it mean playing fast and passing?
I mean, it can mean that. I'm so sick of hearing the argument that, oh, they can't play fast because that'll put the defense on the field too much. Hey, you know what puts the defense on the field too much? When you have six consecutive punts to start the game. Yeah. That puts the defense on the field too much. Okay, so the next time I hear a color analyst say that, I am going to lose it. More grievances. But I do think that people confuse correlation with causation with the tempo.
Yes. But that was the offense. What we saw in the second half is the offense. That's it.
Yeah.
That should be the offense from the very beginning every single game. Look, sometimes you're going to have three and outs. That's what happens. It's football. You're going to have three and outs no matter what your offense is. Every single team in the NFL has them.
Yes.
But that was it. We found what the offense should be, and it was Russell Wilson passing the ball most of the time, using tempo, getting it to different receivers. If you're going to run the ball, you spread it out to run the ball.
So do you think that's going to happen this week?
I do.
You have always been the optimist of this podcast. We've always said that.
I mean, they saw success, and it was something that we didn't see for the previous 10 quarters.
Nine and three quarters. The red zone offense definitely regressed hard to the mean last week.
I mean, it was great to see touchdowns. In a lot of ways, I don't want to rationalize because this is a tough loss, but you're losing to a non-conference opponent on the road that the Seahawks have always lost to. Like, let's take these...
What do you mean always lost to? I don't understand that comment.
Name a good AFC team that they have beaten at the beginning of the season.
At the beginning of the season?
Name one.
I mean, I guess we thought Houston was a good AFC team the year that they beat them.
They really got lucky to win that game, too.
They sure did. And Matt Schaub was never the same. Never the
they
same.
They may have
ever
broken
again.
Matt Schaub, but the Seahawks should have lost that game at Houston. They yeah, lost I mean, to the Colts when they were given every single chance to win.
All right, I guess that's valid. I mean, I thought you were going to say New the name an AFC team they've beaten on the road, and I was going to point out New England.
I mean, yes, okay, they had one win against New England. That wasn't really even the early season.
No, it wasn't.
This is a game that the Seahawks lose every single year, and they lose every single year to the Packers.
But see, this is the
they
thing.
They just
is that,
happen to fall. There are a lot of teams who have had two home games and are 2-1. Yeah, that is what the Seahawks would be.
You understand that
had,
the Seahawks scored, what was it, 15 points? What was the total against San Francisco? Against a team that then gave up like 77 against L.A.?
But the defense also looked better. Like, you can't...
I think that you people can be too patient right now.
What are we supposed to do?
Well, I think you should definitely panic.
I think you should definitely panic.
We should definitely start calling for Pete Carroll's firing on Twitter. I think it's a good response.
Look,
but
here's what I understand.
I'm just saying, I don't think people are having appropriate fear of the Seahawks missing the playoffs right now because that is a real possibility.
God, you're saying that's your statement every year, and you're bringing it out too early.
I mean, let's look at what the statistics say.
Save it for a couple of years ago, you said that at like week 8.
It was a real possibility at that point.
The thing that I understand about football is that people judge things too much because they're not looking at where the games are happening and who teams are playing. And that is what happened. The Seahawks played two
Football Outsider says the Seahawks less than 50% to make the playoffs right now.
Opponent adjustments are not involved.
Oh, because of the fact that they've played such a brutal schedule so far?
They played two probable playoff teams on the road.
They also played San Francisco at home.
Then they won!
Barely.
Look, no, I agree with you that San Francisco should have been a better game, but they lost the two games that they should have lost, and they won the game they should have won. That's it.
So the interesting thing about doing the research for this week's opponent, the Colts, is I'm suddenly a little bit nervous about this game.
I'm terrified.
Despite the fact that Indianapolis comes in here 1-2, having held on to beat the Cleveland Browns last week for their first victory. And with Jacoby Brissett at quarterback with Andrew Luck ruled out again this week as he starts working his way back to the lineup. The Colts come in with the number 32 offense in DVOA.
Where does that rank out of?
The number 32 passing offense out of 32. But here's the thing. That's almost all because of the fact that Scott Tolzien was so unbelievably bad during his three quarters of football against the San Francisco.
Why they decided to start him to begin the season?
What? Yeah, I mean, I guess just
they didn't have Brissett for that long.
Yeah, he didn't know the system, that sort of thing. But still, would have been a better option than Scott Tolzien because literally anyone, like kneeling the ball, would have been a better option than Scott Tolzien. That's how bad he was in that stretch. Jacoby Brissett, since he took over at the end of that game, has a better QBR this season than Russell Wilson.
I know, I'm scared of Jacoby Brissett.
He's completing 61% of his passes with just one interception. He's averaging 8.2 yards per attempt, and he's been a bit of a threat as a runner, although he doesn't look very fast when he runs. I don't know if you've noticed that. I was watching some of the Colts Browns
game. I have not noticed
game,
that he doesn't look fast when he runs.
On Sunday at the bar. It was one of the games that was on TV in front of us. It's kind of like he's big and there's like a lot of motion going on when he runs the ball. Now, the one thing the Colts have not done well with either Scott Tolzien or Jacoby Brissett at the controls is protect their quarterback. Those guys have been sacked a combined 11 times, leaving the Colts 29th in adjusted sack rate. And if we don't see the Seahawks get some sacks this week, I mean, in fairness, Tennessee has only allowed two sacks for -5 yards.
Good. Tennessee's good.
Yeah, they're good. Yeah, they're the old Seahawks. I mean, they don't have the Seahawks defense, but if we don't see the Seahawks get some sacks this week, there is real trouble. Now, the Colts may get back this week. They're starting center Ryan Kelly, who's expected to return to practice after breaking a bone in his foot during the preseason, so that could help their protection a little bit. If you look at targets, it's really all T.Y. Hilton.
Yes.
Wouldn't mind seeing, even though, you know, There's not necessarily been a huge disparity between him and Jeremy Lin and Shaq Griffin so far this season. This is a week I wouldn't mind seeing Sherman travel around.
Yes.
Because T.Y. Hilton is averaging 11.8 yards per target so far this season, whereas Dante Moncrief, kind of their deep threat, has only caught 5 of 15 passes thrown his way, and Kamar Aiken has caught 5 of 12 passes for 3.6 yards per target. Although I will note the caveat, I think
he had a negative 50-yard catch.
I think Eric Decker came into last week averaging like 4.2 yards per target, and he gave it to the Seahawks pretty good last week.
Oh, I don't know about that.
He
had a couple catches.
Also drew a pass interference. I don't know if you recall that.
Oh, I recall it quite well.
The Colts also come in 27th in rushing DVOI, which is slightly better than the Seahawks' 30th rank on defense in rushing DVOI. But a lot of this poor ranking is due to rookie Marlon Mack, who has 16 carries for 21 yards so far this season. That is not good. Mack missed last week's game due to a shoulder injury. We'll see if he's back, but saw a lot more Robert Turbin in that one. Frank Gore, just 3.0 yards per carry so far. Probably a little bit past his expiration date, I think, as a starting running back in the NFL.
He's a little bit past his expiration?
He was still effective last season, okay. I would say. And probably not benefiting from playing with Scott Tolzien early in the season. But in general, this is an Indianapolis defense the Seahawks should be able to hold in check, particularly at home on a Sunday night.
But I would expect Sherman to follow T.Y. Hilton. I mean, to me, if there's anything that scares me about this Colts offense, it's obviously T.Y. Hilton.
Yep.
And if the Seahawks don't shut down the Colts run game, if they don't hold them to, let's say, under 4 yards per carry, I think it should be more, but if they don't
that's a low bar.
Under 4 yards per carry, then it's a bad sign for the Seahawks.
Then you're going to join me on Concerned Island, Appropriate Fear Island.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still on the should have kept atop a Reuben Island.
Yeah, that's a good island to be on. But last week, T.Y. Hilton, 7 catches for 153 yards, including a 61-yard touchdown.
He was being shut down by the Browns' number one corner.
You know, one of the guys in front of me was wearing a Joe Hayden jersey.
Was he?
Yeah. Also, that group of Cleveland fans, they left like midway through the fourth quarter, and then the team came back. It made it interesting. They did not have appropriate faith in
Maybe
DeSean
that's when
Kizer.
They think games end for the Browns.
Well,
but
if the shoe fits.
I believe that Sherman will follow T.Y. Hilton, and I think that the Seahawks will stop this run game. Like I said, if they let Frank Gore all of a sudden discover a fountain of youth in this one, it's a very bad sign for the rest of the season. You know, we have to start rethinking what the Seahawks are as a defense.
Yes. Other side of the football, the Colts have been pretty competitive, all things considered. They rank number 15 in defensive DVOA, including 18th against the pass, despite the fact that their top cornerback, Vontae Davis, has not yet played this season due to a groin injury. He is expected to make his debut this week, on track for that. The Colts have not, as they historically don't, been getting much of a pass rush. They're 27th. In adjusted sack rate, according to Football Outsiders. And journeyman John Simon, who is new to the team, is the only player on the Colts defense with more than one sack.
Who the Seahawks, what defensive lineman the Seahawks make look like a superstar?
Yeah, there's not an obvious candidate this week.
Maybe it's John Simon.
It certainly could be if he's lined up at right outside linebacker. Colts have been 11th so far against the run, so you know, may not be another may again be difficult for the Seahawks to establish the run in this one.
These are not adjusted for opponent, and they played the Browns.
They have played the Browns. Let's see, they played the Rams, and who was their middle game in that? I don't know. I can look this up though. I have this information available. The Arizona Cardinals was the other team they faced. The one place
they're just plowing through the NFC West.
They really are. The Colts defense has actually been worse so far by DVOA than the Seahawks special. The Colts special teams, I should say, has been actually been worse so far than the Seahawks special teams. Their one bright spot so far, their punting, were Rigoberto Sanchez.
Oh.
And I'm always excited to get a Rigoberto Sanchez mention in here.
I was saying, you're going to think of a pun for Sunday.
Has replaced the retired Pat McAfee.
Seahawks should be able to pass the ball here. They should be able to do most everything against this Colts defense. I feel confident that they are going to take what they did in the second half against Tennessee and carry it over. And I believe that that will be the offense from the very beginning. I'll be disappointed if they start this game with 6 consecutive punts.
The Colts are a 13, or the Seahawks are a 13-point favorite
that
in this game.
Way too much.
Shockingly high. Like, have you been watching the last couple weeks?
No.
Did you watch that 49ers game when they were like 13.5-point favorites and narrowly won?
They should be like a 6.5-point favorites.
I would go maybe 7.5. I think 7.5 is appropriate.
But that is way too high.
Do you think there will be an emotional lift with Kenny Easley's jersey retirement at halftime in this game?
Not really.
Okay.
The thing is, football stadiums are really big. And it's very difficult to provide emotional lifts. The crowd feels really separated from the players themselves. I feel like, especially a moment where Kenny Easley, it's like, sure, people in the crowd like Kenny Easley, but I hate to break it to the Seahawks, but most of the fans bought their tickets in like 2005.
I like that. I was looking at the Seahawks website today, and they've got the prices. The price break is whether you bought your season tickets before 2008.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like, it's pretty long after Kenny Easley's retirement.
Not a lot of fans who are around during the Kenny Easley era. You know, Cortez Kennedy is one thing. Matt Hasselbeck would be another thing.
Oh, wow.
It would be great to retire, to have a ceremony for Matt Hass against the Colts, especially, where he ended his career. But I just don't see Kenny Easley as the type of person who people are going to rally around, or it's going to change the climate of the game.
Okay.
But they should be able to pass the ball in this game.
Okay.
And if the Seahawks, again, I said this against San Francisco, this is the week that they need to dominate.
Dominate?
A close win is, I mean, they're, was it 12.5-point favorites?
13.5. Or 13-point favorites.
13-point favorites. If they don't cover that spread, again, then we have to start considering, maybe you're right that we should be afraid that they're not going to make the playoffs.
I mean, I think if they win by 10 points, I mean, that's not going to be a concern to me.
That's not enough.
Not enough. Huh.
I mean, I think the spread is too high, but if the Seahawks want to be the team that is going to be the clear favorites in the NFC West and a contender in the NFC, they need to start beating teams badly, because that's what good teams do.
That is what good teams do.
And it feels like it hasn't happened in a very long time. But my thinking is they've played pretty difficult games.
Except for the one extraordinarily easy.
San Francisco's not that bad. Every team who has played the Seahawks closely, I think, is not that bad. Tampa Bay in the Super Bowl year was not that bad. underrated, to be honest.
Like Glennon, what
a every single one of the years that Ryan Fitzpatrick started in Seattle, he was not that bad either. But
I guess the last time the Seahawks blew out an opponent was the Rams on Thursday Night Football last year in Week 15, 24-3. Although that didn't feel that dominant.
No, they need a blowout here. I mean, people are so desperate for it. It's Sunday night. This is the right environment for it.
Oh, I guess they did beat Detroit 26-6 in the playoffs. I guess that did qualify as a blowout. I'm forgetting that.
So, and I think that they can do it here. I fully believe that Gerald Bevel and Pete Carroll saw the offense in the second half and said to themselves, we can do that for an entire game.
All right. That said, chances of victory?
85%.
We're going back to our usual trend here. I'm going to be 5% less. I'm going 80%.
You know, like I said, I just think that I believe that the offense will carry over. If Doug Baldwin plays, you know, I'm not worried about these drops. It's a flash in the pan, right? I think they regress on third down. I would love to see Jimmy Graham be involved more. And seeing Jimmy Graham in space last week was so exciting.
That was exciting.
So I would like to see that more, and like to see Tyler Lockett get involved. I mean, these deep passes, the Seahawks have pretty good success on them.
Yeah, particularly at home.
So we'd like to see more of those. And then if a couple of those things hit, the Colts are not able to provide kind of response.
Yeah, they're not equipped to come back.
Yes. So it could be the type of situation where if the Seahawks, God forbid, scored a touchdown on their first drive, even in the first quarter, let's say the first six drives, then they have the opportunity. I mean, I think this would have been the case against Tennessee also, but they have the opportunity to possibly put this game away early.
You're very optimistic.
Cockeyed optimist.
All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.